Was Jesus really born of a virgin? Were there three wise men who visited him? Were there shepherds in the field that night when he was born? Is his birthday really on December 25th? There are plenty of myths surrounding the birth of Jesus, and we will separate myth from reality on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. Please check it out. There are hundreds of hours of study material there, blogs and podcasts. So go to it. All right. So we are continuing the series on the advent of the Redeemer. And we are looking at it from the perspective of God's spiritual enemies. And in the last podcast, we looked at how throughout the Old Testament, Satan has done everything in his power to try to prevent the birth of Christ. And of course, he failed every single time, and he will continue to fail. And in the next podcast, we're going to talk about how once Jesus was born, he continued to ramp up his efforts to keep Jesus from fulfilling his mission. But in this podcast, I want to talk about another spiritual enemy of God who does their part to try to prevent us from truly understanding and truly believing in the first advent of Christ. And those spiritual enemies are the secularists, the unbelievers. And I want to talk about some of the myths that surround the birth of Jesus and the efforts that certain people make to disparage the birth and try to just make it seem like it didn't really happen or didn't happen the way Christians think it did. And again, in an effort to destroy the Christian faith. And then we'll look at what really happened around the birth of Christ and some of the myths that even Christians believe that aren't true. And the reason for this is because it's important to understand the reality of what happened, not the euphemized that we've become familiar with from our Sunday school stories and our Christmas plays and things like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that necessarily, but again, I want you to have a reality-based Christian worldview. But we're going to start with some of the secular nonsense. And I was on YouTube. I was watching some things on YouTube. And the reason being, to be perfectly candid, is that I am planning later this year to start broadcasting Faith by Reason on YouTube as well as the podcast. The plan is to start doing that sometime this year, later this year, starting with the series on the Book of Revelation. So I'm really looking forward to that. And in doing that, I've been watching some YouTube videos of other people who are doing Christian teaching on YouTube so that I can kind of see some best practices from them to see what they're doing, what they're not doing, so I can maybe emulate some things that I like and, of course, not do things that I don't like that they're doing. So when you do that with YouTube when you're watching YouTube at all, what happens is they have an algorithm that looks at your viewing history and gives you recommendations based on things you've viewed before. So since I have been viewing a lot of Christian stuff and other religious-based programming, when I pull up YouTube, in my recommendations are things that they think are similar, even if they're not necessarily similar. If they're somewhere in the realm of Christianity or have Christianity in the title, it appears in my recommendations list, first thing I see. So one day, not so long ago, a couple weeks ago, I went to YouTube, and in my recommendations, there was a video, and the title of the video was this person, I'm not going to give their name because I don't want to promote them, but it said, this person blows the lid off of Christianity. Now, what I should have done, the smart thing to do would have just been to ignore it and go on, but I wasn't feeling very smart at the time, and I was intrigued by the title of someone saying they could blow the lid off Christianity. Again, I knew they couldn't. You can't. Christianity is the most documented faith system. The Bible is the most documented book in the history of the world because people have been trying to disprove it since the day the first word of the Bible was written. Someone's been trying to disprove it, and they've all failed. And the reason they failed is because the Bible is true, because God is real. So I should have let it go, but I didn't, and I watched it. And it turned out it was a talk show, more or less, a YouTube talk show, by a guy named Rock Newman. And that name probably means nothing to you unless you were a boxing fan in the 90s, which I was. And if you were, you probably knew, if you follow heavyweight boxing, Rock Newman was the manager and promoter of a boxer named Riddick Bowe. Okay, it's pretty trivial information, I'll admit. But now Rock Newman has his own talk show 20 years later. Anyway, Rodney was an African American, and he had a guy on, and he, his show apparently talks about African American subjects, which is fine. No, nothing wrong with that at all. But the guy he had on, the person who's going to blow the lid off Christianity, was one of these guys who is, he said he's a professor or whatever. And he, you know what he does? He proves an old axiom that I remember hearing, that I love this axiom. It comes from a man named Dr. Stanley Monteith of Radio Liberty, the late Stanley Monteith. He passed away a few years ago. Radio Liberty was a Christian radio station that I used to listen to. And what Dr. Stan, he would call some people, he said they were educated beyond their intelligence. And I love that saying, educated beyond their intelligence. What that means is that they have been, they've gone to school and been given access to a ton of knowledge, but they're not smart enough to properly digest it and properly interpret the knowledge they've been given. So they have more knowledge than they're smart enough to actually deal with. And this guy was the epitome of that. His whole thing in a nutshell was that Jesus, in the birth of Jesus, in the life of Jesus, Jesus was not real. There was no such thing as, there was no such person as Jesus. And that Jesus, the person who Christians call Jesus, he was made up, and he was copied on the Egyptian god Horus, of the Osiris, Isis, and Horus narrative from Egyptian mythology, and that Jesus is basically a copy of that. Now, of course, let's just forget about the fact that the existence of Jesus is so historically documented that even real secular historians, not Christian historians, but secular historians who actually are educated to their level of intelligence, don't even deny that a man existed named Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago. They deny his divinity, but they don't deny that he existed, because anyone with half a brain who does any type of real research can tell that there is too much historical evidence, biblical and non-biblical, that Jesus of Nazareth walked the earth. He existed. But this guy, again, educated beyond his intelligence, said that there was no Jesus. And in fact, Jesus is based, what was copied from the Osiris, Isis, Horus story. Horus, H is silent. In a nutshell, the story, if you don't know it, the story is that these are Egyptian gods, which means they're actually demons, but these are Egyptian gods, and the reason that's important is because, you know, because he's African-American and he wants to promote the Africanism, that racial superiority of African people, which, again, is stupid. Not just African racial superiority, any racial superiority is stupid. We've talked about this during the series on Darwin, how racism is the dumbest rationalization on earth. Just because you fell out of your mother's womb a certain color or a certain hair texture or nose size does not make you better or worse than any other person. All it means is that you happen to be born, and everyone was born, so you can't be better than anyone else when all you've done is accomplish the same thing that everyone else has accomplished. So the story is that Isis and Osiris were married. They were husband and wife. Osiris was the sun god. Osiris had an enemy named Thoth who killed him and cut him into 14 pieces. Isis found 13 of the 14 pieces. She couldn't find one. That one piece she couldn't find happened to be his male sexual organ, his penis. And so she put all the pieces back together except for the one, I guess, in order to do some type of resurrection of him. But since she couldn't find his sex organ, she made one out of stone. And forgive my language, but she made a stone dildo, which she had sex with, so she used it the way a dildo is supposed to be used, I suppose, and she became pregnant, and she had her child Horus, who is supposed to be the resurrected reincarnation of Osiris. And Horus, being the son of the sun god, is called the Son of God. Wow. And according to this guy, and this is something I've studied the whole that Egyptian mythology, and he brought up something I've never heard before, which is that he said that before Isis had her intercourse with this stone penis, she was a virgin, which, again, that's new information. Never heard that before, but whatever. So technically, Horus was the product of a virgin birth, the son of God and the sun god. And it's also said that Horus was born on December 25th. And when Horus was born, there were three stars in the sky. That constellation was these three stars came into existence. And those three stars were called the three wise men. And it's also said that since Horus is the son of the sun god. He represents the sun. And when you see the sun shining on water reflecting, the Egyptians say that that's a show of Horus, the son of God, walking on water. Oh my goodness. What do you have here? You have the son of God. You have him walking on water. He was born on December 25th. There were three wise men who visited. All this thing, virgin birth. Good grief. Obviously, Jesus is just a copy of Horus, of that story, right? Well, and that was his whole premise, is that Christians just copied this legend and slapped Christian names on it, and that Jesus isn't real. He's basically just a plagiarized version of the Osiris Isis Horus story. This, folks, is a spectacularly stupid, unbelievably ignorant premise. I mean, it's laughable. There are so many things wrong with this story. I could actually do a 2-hour podcast pointing out every single thing that's wrong, but we don't have that much time. So let me just give you the highlights, or rather the lowlights. Oh, sorry. And also one more thing, that since Osiris since Horus was the reincarnation of Horus is a resurrected Osiris, and technically that's another sign, because that's a resurrection part in the story. So you also can throw that in. The Christians copy that with the resurrection story. Okay, the first thing that's wrong on a global level, and we've talked about this in the past when we had the series on why religions seem similar, and that is that just because two things are similar doesn't mean one is copied on the other. I mean, that's just logical. I mean, this guy educated beyond his intelligence. Even if you had a third grade education, you realize that just because two things have some similarities don't mean they're the same. Let's take a couple stories that seem similar, or that have a few vague similarities. You have The Lord of the Rings, that whole book series, one of the most famous book series ever, The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. And then you have the Twilight books from about, 15 years ago with those stupid movies, and the Teeny Bopper books. They actually have about as much in common as Jesus and Horus. About five things. I could think about 5 to 10 things that Jesus and Horus have in common. And you can think about 5 to 10 things that, in a general superficial sense, The Lord of the Rings has in common with the Twilight books. Well, first of all, they're both books. They have that in common. They were both made into movies. They have that in common. They both have a very strong supernatural component. They both have a very strong romance in it, and they also have miraculous births and deaths in them. So obviously, because they have a few things in common, it is pretty obvious that Twilight is just a copy of Lord of the Rings, right? Of course not. If you've read both books, and hopefully you haven't read the Twilight books, but if you've been vaguely familiar with both of those narratives, you know that they are nothing alike. Why? Even though they have a few things in common, what's more important is the things that they have in deference. You contrast them. The things that the way they contrast is way more important and way more pertinent than the few things they have in common. The same thing with Jesus and Horus. Let me give you one more example. Let's say I had a car and I wanted to convince you that my car was a Ferrari. How would I do it? Would I do it by telling you how it's like every other car or how it's different? Let's try. Let's say I want to convince you I have a Ferrari, and I tell you, hey, you know what? I've got a Ferrari. And because the reason my car is a Ferrari is because it has four wheels. Now, would that convince you I had a Ferrari? Of course not. Why? Because all cars have four wheels. Okay, well, my Ferrari also has seats. Okay, would that convince you? No, all cars have seats. Well, my Ferrari has a steering wheel. So what? All cars have steering wheels. Well, my Ferrari has an engine. Well, all cars have engines. So far, I haven't convinced you by telling you things that Ferrari has in common with all other cars. But what if I told you my car is a sports car? Well, okay. Well, Ferraris are sports cars, and not all cars are sports cars. So, okay, you listen to me now. Okay, and also, my car is made in Italy. Okay, well, Ferraris are made in Italy, and all cars are not made in Italy, so that's different. That differentiates my car from all the other cars. And I would tell you, well, my car, the symbol for my car on the hood is a horse standing up on its hind legs. Okay, now that's even more convincing, because that is a symbol for Ferrari and maybe a couple other cars. So now I'm narrowing things down. Why would you believe me about the Ferrari? Because I'm pointing out what's different about it. The only way to prove what something is to prove how it differs from other things. And the only way to prove things are the same is if everything is the same. The only way to prove that Jesus and Horus are the same story is if they have every single thing in common. If they don't, then those differences make them different. And the more differences they are, the further apart they are, and the less likely anyone with a rational brain will believe they're the same thing. If I do have a Ferrari and someone else has a smart car, are you going to believe they're the same car because they all have four wheels and seats and an engine and a steering wheel? Of course not. What's important is how they're different, and the more differences they have, the further apart they are. And so I will grant you that there may be 5 to 10 very superficial similarities between the story of Jesus and the story of Oris, but there are over 300 prophecies, specific prophecies of Jesus, that Oris had nothing to do, that Oris did not do at all. Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Oris wasn't born in Bethlehem. Jesus died on the cross, predicted. Oris didn't die on the cross. Jesus was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. That's prophesied. Didn't happen to Oris. I could go on and on. In fact, I did that in a couple podcasts ago, where I just went through the odds of all these, of anyone else being Jesus. I named just 9 things that were impossible for anyone else to fulfill. And there are over 300 things that Jesus did that have nothing to do, that are completely divorced from the story of Oris. So the obvious answer is they are not the same, not even remotely. One was not copied from the other just because they have a few vague similarities in common. And the other things that make this even more stupid is that even the things he claimed, this guy claimed that they had in common, still weren't even similar at all. In that, for example, he said Oris was born on December 25th. Great. Jesus wasn't. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. The wise men thing, Jesus wasn't visited by 3 wise men. We'll talk about that. There are just a ton of things that make this just spectacularly stupid. And the guy who did it is just a complete moron. And it just amazes me that more people don't call him on it. And I looked in the comments on the YouTube, just waiting for someone to call him out for all the things that he had wrong. And I shouldn't be surprised, but I was. I was surprised that no one did. It kept saying, oh, wow, that's fascinating. This really makes me rethink Christianity. Yeah, this proves Christianity is just a joke, blah, blah, blah. Like, seriously? But what it does is just show the vast level of ignorance that people have about the Bible. And if you're ignorant about the Bible, that's fine. No one's forcing you to be a biblical scholar. But if you're not a biblical scholar, don't talk about the Bible. You're going to look dumb like this idiot on YouTube. And why did I bring that up? Why did I spend so much time on this guy? Because even though, again, he's a complete moron, he's not alone. When I went to college, I heard all kinds of professors giving me all these crazy ideas about how Christianity was false and how all religions are the same, so forth and so on. As I said, we talked about it in an earlier podcast. And you're going to encounter it. And if you don't know the truth, you can't combat the lies. So that's the purpose of this podcast, is to give you some of the truth and point you in that direction. The Bible will prove itself, and these people will prove their biblical ignorance. So if you are biblically astute, you can easily disprove them and not fall for any of their nonsense. So let's talk about what really happened when Jesus was born. First of all, it was a virgin birth. Jesus was born of a virgin. Isaiah predicted it. He said that this will be a sign unto you, that, you know, that Jesus, you know, his coming had been predicted from Genesis chapter 3, the seed of the woman. And then Isaiah says that it will be a sign. A virgin shall conceive and bear a child. That's a pretty significant sign. A virgin who's never had intercourse with a man produces a child. Well, here's another thing the secularists bring up. That word that is translated virgin in Isaiah, technically it means young maiden. So the secularists who try to deny that Jesus had any divinity say, all this means is, all Isaiah was saying is that a young woman was going to get pregnant. That doesn't mean it was a virgin birth. There's a few problems with that. First of all, the word young maiden really does mean virgin in that culture, because a maiden is an unmarried woman. It was fairly presumed that if you were a maiden, if you were unmarried, you were a virgin. Why? As we talked about a few podcasts ago, in that culture, in the Jewish culture at that time, sex was marriage. So if she had sex, she would no longer be a maiden. She would be married to whomever she had sex with. So when you call a woman a maiden, when you say she's unmarried, you are saying she's a virgin. So it's one and the same. It's like if someone said, well, you know, that verse said that he was a toddler, but he was actually a child. Well, a toddler is a child. It's the same thing. A maiden is a virgin. And furthermore, what if it just meant young woman having a baby, how would that be a sign? A young woman having a baby is nothing miraculous. Oh, I mean, yeah, obviously the birth is miraculous in that sense, but it wouldn't be a supernatural event. Young women have babies all the time. In fact, as I speak, there are many young women who are currently giving birth, just using, just the odds of all the population and how many people are pregnant and giving birth. Yeah, I'm pretty sure there are young women giving birth right now. Not a supernatural event. So she was a virgin, and she conceived the baby Jesus. And it was a wonderful event for her. Now, I was watching another TV show, which, again, probably bad news. I shouldn't watch any TV because TV is terrible. But I was watching this show, a comedy that was recommended to me by a friend, and I'm pretty much mad at that friend now for recommending it to me. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I don't want to promote it. But it was a comedy about this young girl who got pregnant and is a single mother, and she's a bitter millennial because, she got pregnant and the baby is stopping her from living the life she wants to live, and so she's cynical. And of course, she also is anti-religious. She hates God, and she doesn't like Christians, and she has a snide view of Christianity, which is pretty much, I think it's pretty much a requirement if you have a TV show that you disparage God and Christianity at some point, if not often in your show. That along with the requirement that there be at least one gay person on your show, I think those are the things that you absolutely have to have. That's the minimum requirements in order to have a TV show disparage Christianity and have a gay person. Anyway, her mother on the show, who was a Catholic, was talking about, the Blessed Mother, Virgin Mary, blah, blah, blah. And this girl basically said, well, Mary was the virgin, but she didn't want to be. God just made her wake up one day pregnant, and it was unwanted. So she basically made it seem like God forced himself on Mary and essentially raped her and gave her this child, which she was not looking for. And so God's this horrible person, blah, blah. It's silly and stupid and ignorant for the same reasons as the other one was ignorant. If you just look at the Bible and have any kind of biblical literacy, you would see that's not the case. For, again, a few reasons. First of all, this woman, Mary, the Virgin Mary, did not live in 2019. She lived 2,000 years ago, completely different culture. Back then, a baby was not considered an inconvenience. A baby was a blessing. In fact, the whole thing of babies being inconvenient, that's very new in our culture. It's less than 100 years old. For 99% of our history, a woman having a baby was a beautiful thing. It's something that women longed for. It was the most feminine thing you could do, was give birth to a child. It's something that a man can't do, and that women, it was a source of pride. It is a source of pride for most women, unless you're, again, a cynical millennial or whatever. Also, being the mother of the Messiah was what women, Jewish women, longed for. There was no greater honor. Having a man's child was an honor, and bearing the child of God, the Messiah, the Son of God, was the highest possible honor. It's what every woman longed for. One of the titles of Jesus in the Old Testament is the desire of women. Every woman desired to be the vessel through which the Messiah came into the world, including Mary. Now, that's not to say that there may have been one or a few women here and there who didn't want to be pregnant and have a baby. I suppose it's possible, if not likely. But Mary wouldn't have been one of those. Why? Because it would have been unjust of God to force that upon her, and God is not unjust. God is righteous and just. We know his nature, so he would not force this upon someone who did not want it. And then if you just read the Bible, you see how Mary was thrilled and honored and humbled to be the vessel of Christ. Okay, moving on. Mary was betrothed to a man named Joseph. Mary was probably somewhere between 14 and 20 years old, because that's the age when young women got married back then. She was betrothed, meaning she was engaged, in our language, to Joseph, who was a fair amount older than her. We don't know how old he was, but we know that he was definitely older than her. And we also, one of the reasons we know he was older was because when Jesus began his ministry, at 30 years old, Joseph was dead. How do we know Joseph was dead? Because Jesus, being the eldest son of Mary's other children, and yes, Catholics, sorry, Mary had a bunch of other children. The Bible talks about them very clearly. Jesus was the eldest, and when Jesus died on the cross, he gave the care of his mother Mary to the apostle John. That is something that only the eldest child would do, and he would only do it if the head of the household, the father, was dead. So Joseph was dead by the time Jesus was an adult. So somewhere between the ages of 12 and 30, Joseph died. So he's probably fairly older than Mary. Okay, moving on again. They had to go to Bethlehem. Why? Because the Roman Emperor Augustus Caesar called a census for everyone throughout the Roman Empire. And everyone had to travel to the town of their birth to be counted in the census. Joseph was born in Bethlehem. That's why they had to go to Bethlehem, even though Mary was, they said, in the Bible says she was great with child, meaning she was around the ninth month. They had to travel all the way down to Bethlehem. This is a reason why we know Jesus was not born on December 25th. Aside from the fact that December 25th is the idiot on YouTube had one thing correct, that the December 25th is considered the birth of the pagan sun god, Sol Invictus, Nimrod, Osiris, Horus. Yes, they were all born on December 25th because that's when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky. I'm sorry, the December 21st is when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky, and then it starts rising up again towards in its highest point during summer. So they call that the birth of the sun, the god of the sun. But Jesus was not born on December 25th. Why? Because Augustus Caesar, whatever else he was a very smart man. He would not have everyone in the entire empire travel during winter. December 25th is the dead of winter. Many parts of the empire, including Judea, was impassable due to ice and snow. So, of course, he didn't do it then. He would do it during warmer months. And for those of you who don't have a calendar, let me assure you, December is not a warm month. Jesus was not born in December. It's idiotic. The only reason we celebrate it is because we still hold on to the Catholic pagan traditions. Catholicism is basically a blend of Christianity and paganism. And they kept the pagan worship of the sun god, and they just slapped Jesus' name on it. And now that's why we have Christmas on December 25th. But that's not when Jesus was born. Another reason, there were shepherds in the field. Shepherds came to visit Jesus. So around the time of Jesus' birth, there were shepherds in the field at night. They would not be out at night in the dead of winter because their sheep would freeze to death. And if you're a shepherd, your job is to keep sheep safe. Having them out and having them freeze to death would not be a really good job duty. Why were they out in the field? When they're out in the field, that meant it was a time of year when the shepherds sheared the sheep for their wool. They were out there because it took a long time to shear the sheep. They didn't have electric clippers like we have today. They had to do it by hand, and it took a really long time. And they wanted to get it to market as quickly as possible. So instead of having the sheep out in the field in the day and then put them in the barn at night and then trot them out again, which would take extra hours, they just kept them in the field all night and all day, and they would cut all the wool off of them. So the reason they had their sheep out at night was because it was the time of year when the summer coats of the sheep are shaved off to bring wool to the market. That happened in late summer, towards either around from the end of August to the beginning of October in our calendars. So that's when Jesus was born, sometime between August and October, most likely September. Okay, another myth dispelled. Ah, but what about the three wise men? Well, just like the Bible doesn't say Jesus was born on December 25th, the Bible also does not say there were three wise men. The Bible simply says there were wise men, plural. Wise men came from the East. Now, the term wise men, the term that's translated wise men, is actually the word magi, the magi from the East. They were a royal priesthood from Persia. Now, I know you'll sometimes see in some of the Christmas cards and Christmas paintings, some of the wise men painted with Asian features, because when they see wise men from the East, they assume as far east as possible, meaning the Far East, the Orient, Asia. No, they were not Asian, they were Persian. Very interesting story, actually, about who these magi are. Very interesting. They were actually Jewish. They were a Jewish royal priesthood from Persia. How'd that happen? Well, start it with the prophet Daniel, one of my favorite Old Testament characters. Daniel was a truly fantastic and amazing man of God, a prophet, who wrote his book, Daniel, obviously, during the time of the Jewish captivity in Babylon and later Persia. So the story is that the southern kingdom of Israel, Judah, they fell into disrepair. They fell out of favor with God, and God punished them by having them taken into captivity by Babylon under the king Nebuchadnezzar for 70 years. There was a 70-year captivity. Daniel was a teenager when this happened. So as a teenager, Daniel was carried off into Babylon with the rest of the southern Israelites, where he stayed until his death. But because of his godliness, because of his prayerful life, because of his devotion to God, God showed him special favor. And if you read the book of Daniel, you'll see all these things happening. Daniel elevated himself and arose to basically being the second in command through, again, God blessing him and God showing him special favor with the king, Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel was shown great prophecies. Daniel interpreted great prophecies. In fact, in addition to the Apostle John through the book of Revelation, he and Daniel together, they are the most prolific writers of the end times, which is a particular point of fascination for me, one of the particular points of study for me, which is, and again, as I said earlier in the podcast, I'm going to do YouTube videos later this year, verse-by-verse examination of Revelation, and you cannot really interpret Revelation unless you've studied the book of Daniel, so there'll be a lot of the Daniel's prophecies in there. So again, great man of God, rose to be the second in command, essentially the prime minister of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. And then when the Babylonian Empire fell and was taken over by the Persians, God showed him favor again. And because of just his integrity and his intelligence and his closeness with God, the Persians who took over the Babylonian Empire, they did the same thing. They made him their second in command. So he's the prime minister of two of the great world empires. Pretty special guy. Now, at the end of the 70 years, Israel was released. The Persian king Cyrus and his successor Artaxerxes put out a decree that allowed the captive Israelites to go back to their land, to go back to Israel. And most of them did. However, there were some of them who decided to stay in Persia. Why? Because that's where they grew up. They had been there for 70 years. So you have an entire generation of people. Everyone under the age of 70 had never seen Israel. They're home for 70 years or a little less, their entire life, they spent in Persia. It was home for them. They were comfortable there. The Jews were actually treated very well by the Babylonians and by the Persians, mostly thanks to Daniel and what he did for the empire. So they had a very comfortable life, and some of them didn't want to leave. Daniel also didn't leave, not because he didn't want to, but because by this time Daniel was an old man. He was probably in his 90s when the decree to go back to Israel happens, and it would have been too far for a man his age to travel. So he stayed in Babylon / Persia, along with a contingent of Jewish people who, again, were comfortable there. It was their home. They built their lives and they wanted to stay there. So, and some of them studied under Daniel. Daniel basically perpetrated in a good way. He cultivated, better word, a priesthood, and this priesthood called the Magi, and they were well respected by the Persians because Daniel was respected. So they were a royal priesthood who were treated very well, and they were advisors to the kings of Persia. Now, fast forward to the time of the birth of Jesus, the Persian Empire was now the Parthian Empire. We don't study the Parthian Empire very much in school, which is kind of surprising considering how much influence they have. The Parthian Empire, they stretch from present-day Jordan, the area we call Jordan, all the way to towards India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. It was a huge empire, and they were rivals to the Roman Empire. Again, the Roman Empire was the dominant empire in the West. The Parthians were dominant in the Middle East, and they were rivals. The Romans were never able to conquer the Parthians. The Parthians gave them fits. That's why the Roman Empire never went as far as Alexander the Great's empire, which went into all the way to Persia when he conquered the Persians. Romans weren't able to beat the Parthians. They were enemies. And in Israel was actually kind of a buffer state. Israel was the furthest east the Romans had gotten, and so Israel was kind of the backwater of the Roman Empire. They were again a buffer state between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire. So when the Magi came. Here's another reason why it's ridiculous to think that there were only three wise men. These were enemies. Three royal priests sneaking over to Israel would be the same as like high-level politicians from North Korea or Russia sneaking over the Bering Strait in Alaska into America and thinking they'd be safe. They wouldn't do that. They're the enemy. They would if they were ever captured, they would be probably executed. So the kings of Parthia would not let their royal priesthood go there and only a group of three unprotected. They would have sent a large military contingent with them to protect them because, again, they were royalty, or they were a step below royalty. They were the prime ministers and the advisors to the king. Furthermore, when the wise men, the Magi, came to Israel, where did they go? They went directly to the house of Herod, who was the appointed king of Israel. If you're three guys in enemy territory, you would not go to the castle, to the fortress of the person who's in charge of the military. You want to sneak around and avoid him. No, they went right to him. And so that's another reason, you know, it wasn't just three. It was a protected military contingent. Furthermore, when they went to Herod, what did they say? They essentially insulted Herod to his face. If you look at the dialogue, what the three wise men said is to Herod was, hey, we've come here to see he who was born king of the Jews. We want to worship him. How is that an insult? Well, because Herod, even though he was a king over Israel, the king over the Jews, he was not Jewish. Herod was an Idumean. He was actually an Edomite. He was a descendant of Esau. Now, the Israelites were descendants of Jacob, Esau's brother. So he was not Jewish. He was not born king of the Jews. He was appointed king of the Jews by the Romans. So basically the Magi were saying, yeah, we know that you've got the title of king of the Jews, but we're here to see the person who was born king of the Jews. That's a slap in the face. And you would not do that unless you had backup. And what was Herod's reaction? Now, if it was just three guys there insulting the king to his face, again, he would have put him to death. He would have been outraged. But he wasn't. Herod was actually scared. When he said, where is he who's born king of the Jews? Herod said, hey, guys, you know, feel free to go find him. You have, you know, free reign throughout the kingdom. Do whatever you want. And when you find him, let me know, and I'll come worship him too. Yeah, Herod was afraid. Why? Again, it was a huge contingent of these magi with military backup. And Herod was scared out of his mind because he thought that there was a border incursion happening. Herod thought that these magi were the precursors to an invasion. And because if the Parthians ever decided to invade the Roman Empire, they would have done it through Israel because there are plenty of trade routes through Jerusalem. It would have been the easiest way for them to start their invasion. So Herod was scared because he thought he was at the forefront of a military invasion and he would be wiped out. So he was trying to be very nice. He was very nice to the Magi. So the Magi, they go, they find Jesus. And so why do we have the silly myth of there being three wise men? Well, a couple reasons. One is that the Magi gave three gifts to Jesus. They gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the baby Jesus. Why? Well, because these three gifts basically highlight the Jesus' role in his first advent. Gold is a gift for kings. So they were acknowledging that Jesus was born king of the Jews. Frankincense is an incense that is for priests. It's for Jewish priests. It's part of the Jewish priesthood to have frankincense burning as a priest. So they acknowledge his role as king and priest. And myrrh was an embalming salve. It's when a person would die, they would put myrrh on him as to embalm him. So they also knew that Jesus' destiny was to die. So these wise men, these magi from hundreds of miles away in Persia, they knew more about the life and career of Jesus than even the people in Israel. They knew more about the Messiah than the Pharisees did. The Pharisees could have taken a lesson from the Magi, and if they did, you know, things would have gone very different. So let me bring up, so that's why, that's one of the reasons why it's depicted as three wise men, because there were three gifts. But just because there were three gifts doesn't mean there weren't three wise men. And the other reason is basically what we see on our Christmas cards and in our Christmas art, and that is the depiction of three guys in robes giving Jesus these three gifts. And that's even a bigger indictment of this doofus on YouTube who thinks he's blowing the lid off Christianity with his shoddy research and below average intelligence, because he's taken his idea that there were three wise men, not from the Bible, not from anything in the Bible, not from any real historical research, but he's basically taking it from Christmas cards. He's basing his refutation of Christianity on a Christmas card and nativity scenes on people's lawns. Moron. I mean, that's like what Dan Brown did. Dan Brown, who wrote that horrible book, Da Vinci Code. Not only was it horrible in its research, but it was just poorly written. It was like, looked like it was written by a 13-year-old. It was just that poorly done. But he also is trying to refute Christianity and say that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. And what's his source material? Not the Bible, not any historical records, but the painting of the Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci. And if you look at that painting, you will see that the person who is supposed to be the Apostle John does look like a female. And he says, well, this proves that Mary Magdalene was at the Last Supper. And if you see the way she is drawn or painted with Jesus next to her and they're holding hands, so she must have married Jesus. Dan Brown, you dork, you idiot. That wasn't a photograph of the Last Supper. That was a painting done over 1,000 years after the Last Supper happened. That's not what those people looked like. Everyone in the Last Supper painting by Da Vinci was Caucasian. The people in the actual disciples and Jesus were Middle Eastern Jews. It wasn't a photograph. It was a painting. How on earth are you going to try to refute Christianity based on a painting that a guy made up? And I'm sure they weren't all sitting on one side of the table. I'm sure they were sitting around the table. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, enough of the Da Vinci Code. That's the dumbest thing. The worst part about the Da Vinci Code is that it actually shook Christians, not Christians who don't know better, who have never done any study. It shook them like, oh, my God, he's right. That does look like Mary Magdalene. That means that maybe he has a point about Jesus marrying her. It's a painting, people. It was not a photograph. It was not. Nobody was there painting that picture 2,000 years ago. It was something a guy painted 1,000 years after the fact. So anyway, moving on. Let's talk about the star that they followed. They said that when they go to Herod, the wise men, the magi, say that, you know, we saw his star, the star of the Messiah in the east, and we followed it to get to him. And this is one of the points where every Christmas you'll see these little programs on the History Channel talking about the birth of Jesus, and then they'll bring in these so-called scholars who come in and try to dispute it. And one of the favorite things to dispute is the idea that there was a star that moved from Persia to Israel and hovered over Bethlehem. That couldn't happen. That's not how stars go. So this was just a fairy tale that Christians made up. No. If you truly understand what they're saying, you realize that's not the case. Of course, a star, which are billions of light years away and are massive, many of them much bigger than our own sun, of course, they're not going to move from Persia to Bethlehem. There are two explanations. I'll tell you one of the first ones, and I'll tell you the next one, which I subscribe to. One is that this wasn't actually a star, that it was actually the Shekinah. What is a Shekinah or Shekinah, depending on how you want to pronounce it? During the wilderness wanderings of the Israelites, when they were going from Egypt to the Promised Land, they were, in the Old Testament, it says that they were guided in their journey by a pillar of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night, which is actually the essence of the Holy Spirit guiding them. And some folks believe that the Shekinah, the spirit, the manifestation of the Holy Spirit, appeared to these wise men, these magi, and led them to Jesus, and it you know, ended up just hovering over the barn where he, in the manger where he was born. Possible. I think the more accurate, more logical explanation is that these magi knew the Masoreth. They were taught the Masoreth by Daniel, and he passed it on. They were Daniel's spiritual and political descendants, and Daniel was a very wise guy. Not in a criminal sense of a wise guy. You know, he's a very wise man. And the Masoreth, and we've talked about this during the series on organized religion, the Masoreth was the message of redemption that God put in the sky, in the stars. It said in Genesis that, you know, God put the stars in heaven to show signs and seasons. And the entire redemption story from the birth of the Messiah all the way through to the second coming, the line of the tribe of Judah, which starts with the constellation we call Virgo and ends with the Leo, the lion. So from the virgin birth to the line of the tribe of Judah, which is Jesus' last title when he comes back in the second coming, is the entire redemption story. I am not talking about astrology. For those of you who are wondering, astrology is demonic. I'm talking about astronomy and the Masoreth. Masoreth is the way. In fact, the first Christians were called the followers of the way. That is how the redemption story could be told before the Bible was written. The Bible started, the first books of the Bible were written by Moses, but there had been a few thousand years of human history before that. How did people before the books of Moses know about the Bible, know about the redemption story? It was in the stars. And again, we discussed this earlier in the series on organized religion. And the reason that some of the early religions seem similar to Christianity, like the stupid Horus, Osiris, Isis story that the YouTube dummies talks about, the reason they were able, they copied that from the Masoreth, because they knew the story was already there, even before the books of Moses were written. The Magi, they also knew the Masoreth, and they were looking at how the constellations moved, and they know that they moved in such a way that the star that represented the Messiah, and I'm not getting to all the details of that now, you can research the Masoreth if you want to, but there's a certain star that represents the Messiah. And when that star is in the constellation Virgo, which is the Virgin, they knew that that meant that the Messiah was going to be born. So they saw his star from the east. Because of why? They were in the East. We saw his star in the East. When we were in the East, we saw his star moving correct in the right way in the constellation to let us know that this was the time of the birth of the Messiah. And so they came to visit him. So that's what the star is. And again, that's another indictment of the Pharisees. They should have known the Maseroth too. They should have been looking in the sky and knowing that the Maseroth had moved, the constellations had moved in such a way to indicate that the Messiah was born, but they missed it, just like they missed a lot of stuff. We'll talk about the Pharisees a couple of podcasts from now. So that is the story of the wise men. All right, so I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm going over time. I want to wrap this up with one final myth, and it's more of a superficial thing, but I think it's important. The reason I'm trying to shatter these myths is because I want you to have as much truth as possible. The more truth you have, the more reality you have, the less likely you are to be moved and fooled by anything that's false, even things that you know you think might not be as much of a big impact on you, or you think it might not have as much impact. So you know, what's the big deal if we believe that there were three wise men instead of a contingent of wise men? Not a big difference in the small picture, but in the big picture, every time you believe something that's not true, it opens the door to you believing more falsehoods. And as falsehoods pile on top of each other, they can eventually get to the point where you just diverge from the truth completely. So, you know, the devil's not, if you're a Christian, the devil's not going to come up at you with something that's going to come out of left field, that's going to be a big lie. He's not going to try to convince you that, you know, God doesn't exist. No, he's going to try to convince you of just one little falsehood. And you say, okay, and you accept that, then he'll eventually convince you of another one and another and another. It's more of a slope. It's not a straight drop down, like, you know, believing something, you know, blasphemous right off the bat. No, he wants to just take you down a gentle slope, as C.S. Lewis called it in the Screwtape Letters. He wants you on that gentle slope down, and next thing you know, you look up and you've been going down this wrong slope for so long, you no longer recognize the truth. So the last myth I want to talk about is where Jesus was actually born. Now, of course, Mary and Joseph, they're going down to Bethlehem, because that's where Joseph was born for the census that Caesar Augustus called. But it took him a long time to get there because Mary was great with child. She was 9 months. She was about to give birth. So, she was not physically able to travel very quickly. So by the time they got to Bethlehem, all the inns, all the hotels of the time, they were full. So they ended up having to stay in a barn. And when we see the nativity scenes and the little Christmas cards and the little Christmas postcards and paintings, oh, it's just such a beautiful, idyllic scene. You have Mary and Joseph in these lovely robes, and Mary has a nice headdress, makes her look almost like a nun for some reason. Yes, some reason. And, you know, you have these animals there and a few, some lambs and maybe a couple of chickens and a cow, and it's all smiling at the baby Jesus. Oh, it's so wonderful. That's not what it was like. Okay, I don't know how many of you have been to a barn or on a farm, but farms are not clean, pristine, idyllic places. I will admit that I'm a city boy. I was born in a big city. I've lived in big cities my entire life. I went to school in big cities. Most of my jobs I've had have been in big cities. I'm a city boy. I'm not a country boy. However, my parents are from the country. My dad is from southern Oklahoma, and my mother's side of family is from East Texas. That is about as rural as it can get. And one of the horrors of my childhood was every summer I had to spend 2 weeks in East Texas with my maternal grandmother, I grew up with her in a city area, but we would always go back to East Texas to visit my Uncle Leo on his farm. And farms are not nice places if you are a city boy. They smell horrible. Animals stink badly. Animals do not have not been toilet trained. They poop and pee anywhere they feel like it. And even though they live in the barn, that they don't go outside of the barn when it's time to go to the bathroom. They stay right there and just do their business right where they are. So if you're inside of a barn, it smells horrific. It smells like animal feces and animal urine. It is, if you're not used to it, it can make your eyes water, make you want to cough and run for the hills, which is what it was like for me every summer. The barn that Jesus was born in was just like this. It was not a sweet and idyllic little campsite. It was a barn full of disgusting animal waste. And that's where he was born. When Jesus first came into this earth, when he was born, when he came from Mary's womb, when he first cried and took his first breath in, the first thing he smelled was animal waste. And when she laid him in a manger, a manger is not a crib, folks. A manger was not meant to hold a baby. A manger is a feeding trough for animals. It's where you put animal food and the animals eat it. And when animals eat, they are not neat. They don't use a knife and fork. They just eat there and their saliva and whatnot, which falls all over the place. And I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that Mary and Joseph did not have time to sanitize the manger before they laid Jesus in it. Jesus was laid in a dirty animal feeding trough. Why is this important? Why did it happen this way? Because Jesus had to come into this world humble. Jesus, even though he didn't deserve to come to the world like this, he's the Son of God. He created the world. He created the land, the land that the barn was on. But why did he come into this earth? Because he came into this earth as a replacement for us. He died for us. He represented us, and he represented how God thought about us. He was lowly and humble and born into the worst circumstances because that's where we were. That's where we are. We are wretched. God says our righteousness, which is the best thing we can possibly do on our own without him. The highest achievements we can get outside of God is as filthy rags. And we just talked about this before. That term filthy rags really means used menstrual cloths. That's what God thinks about our human righteousness. The highest human being, the king living in a castle, is filthy rags. And Jesus came in as the lowest of the low. He came in the worst possible place he could because he represented us. That's why he had to be born in a barn full of animal waste, because he was representing us. He was representing our condition as it is relative to God's. And that's your Christmas story. Okay, folks, I'm going to wrap it up. I'm not going way over. Sorry about that. I'll make a shorter one and shorter podcast next week. Anyway, thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Please send me your comments. I'd love to hear them. And follow me on social media. And next week, we will, after this interlude about the myths of Jesus' birth, we will start talking again about the advent of the Redeemer from the point of view of his spiritual enemies. And we will show how, even though Satan couldn't stop the birth of Jesus, we'll document some of the ways that once Jesus was born, Satan kept trying to off him, to get rid of him. And he didn't wait till Jesus was an adult to try to kill him. Nope, Satan started trying to get rid of him when he was just a baby, because Satan's a jerk. So that'll be next week, and I will talk to you then. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.